have a special guest in with me this morning. Joe Radinovich is here from Greater Minnesota. Joe, thank you so much for coming in.
I appreciate being here. It's good to be in the studio.
Absolutely. Joe is running for District 8's House of Representatives position, replacing Representative Nolan. Someone has got to do it, and you're on the ticket. Joe, so first of all, I just want to thank you for being a public servant. I know that it's not the most thankful job in the world, or it can be very thankless. And just asked, you know, what inspired you to run for office, and particularly this office?
Yeah, well, it certainly can be a pretty tough road during an election. I think anybody who's tuned into the TV or watched a YouTube video lately probably understands that. But that's all right. You know, what made me interested in running for office here in Congressional District 8 is that I was born in the Crosby-Arrington area. I'm the fourth generation of my family to live down there. The Radinovich family came from Yugoslavia about 105 years ago and first settled in Eveleth, working in the mines there. And my branch made it as far down as Crosby-Arrington. Everybody in my family is a working person, electricians, plumbers, pipe fitters, nurses, other healthcare workers. And they're the type of people, I think, who most need a representative, a fighter in Washington, D.C. and in St. Paul. And they're the people who I think are oftentimes at the receiving end of decisions that are made with the influence of special interests. And so there's a whole slate of issues that are really important this year. We're hearing a lot about healthcare, Social Security and Medicare. And also people, I think, are tuned into the fact that there's too much money and it's got a corrupting influence in our political system. So we need to do something about that.
All right. And then if you were to enter office, or if and when, can you explain to us your priorities? And if you could sort of divide it into categories, I always want to know, like, what's the first priority? What do you see as the most in need of immediate attention? And then also, what's the more long-term vision and an area that you feel is really important to focus on?
Yeah, so I'm going to take the second part of that question first, which is what's the sort of the long-term problem I'd like to work on. And I think that the biggest issue facing districts like this, facing a lot of working people across this country, is that technology and mechanization is rapidly disrupting our economy, and that's having an impact sort of across the board on working people. And the example that I use is that in 1980, here in northeastern Minnesota, there was about 14,500 iron miners, and they produced 40 million tons of iron ore. They still produce about 40 million tons of iron ore today in the mines in northeastern Minnesota, but it takes 4,000 miners, right? So that's 10,000 people who used to be able to walk out of school and get a job to support themselves and their family. And of course, that phenomena is not limited to mining. It's happening on farms and factories. It's happening on the highway. It's happening at the grocery store where, you know, when I was a kid, I'd go to the grocery store with my grandpa. Somebody would ring up our groceries. Somebody else would bag them and walk them out. Now, you know, 25, 30 years later, we've got one person standing in a self-checkout bay with four or six kiosks doing the work that maybe six or eight people used to do, but they're not receiving the wages and benefits that those people used to do in some. And that's the real story here of the American economy, I think, over the second part of the 20th century. For the first part of the 20th century, when productivity in America went up, so did worker wages. They got their fair share. Pardon me, I'm losing my voice here.
No but problem.
The second part of the 20th century, what we saw is productivity continued to skyrocket, and wages have stayed flat since about the 1970s, with only about a 7 or 8% increase over that entire time. And so I think that that has led to a lot of problems. You know, my understanding of work is that people don't do it just because they want a paycheck. They do it because that's how they take care of themselves, that's how they take care of their family, and there's a certain dignity that comes from it. But when people, you know, are unsure about whether they're going to be able to afford retirement, or when people can't afford childcare, or when they can't afford health care, then things get to be pretty dire, and it really limits a person's ability to make decisions in the economy. And so I think that that issue overall is the one that we're going to have to wrestle with in this country. I think that we need to make sure that working people have a seat at the table in Washington, D.C. I think that special interests too often rule the roost out there, and it's, you know, that set of issues is really important. In the near term, I think, you know, obviously I'm a Democrat and President Trump is not. And so we're going to have to figure out a way to work with him on some issues if the Democrats take control of the Congress out there. And I think that the issue that we could work with President Trump on is the issue of infrastructure investment. Here in northeastern Minnesota, I actually just saw an interesting map of all the roads in the state of Minnesota. And the whole state is covered in roads except for northeastern Minnesota, right?
Right.
And even some of the roads we know that we have up here are pretty in pretty rough shape. So you could get people back to work rebuilding our infrastructure, putting in broadband from border to border. I think that's a vitally important program. We could be investing in the harbors here on Lake Superior. We could...
I love that as a sailor.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, so there are a lot of things that we could be doing if we mustered the political will to do it. Now, one thing I'll say is that you know, Donald Trump said that when he was running for office. He identified a big infrastructure package was maybe in the works, but we haven't seen any movement on that. And so I think one of the other things that we should be doing as a Congress is, no matter how you feel about President Trump, and certainly I feel a certain way about him, but no matter how you feel about him, I think that one important role that the Congress is going to have to play in the next 2 years is to hold him accountable, at the very least, to the promises he made during the 2016 campaign.
And find the common ground within that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I think that work together on something.
Yep. Infrastructure could be that common ground for us.
Yeah, I often think it doesn't matter so much why people come to the table. It's that they're at the table, and then we don't have to all be at the table for the same reason.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you. That kind of leads to my next question. Maybe you have anything to add. In a time of intense political animosity, can you share what role you hope to play in our political sphere? And you have kind of already said that, but maybe you have more to say.
Yeah. And, you know, this intense political animosity, it's not just limited to what's going on at the national, you know, on the national stage, right? We've got debates going on here in the 8th Congressional District where there are two, you know, strong positions that people care very deeply about, and that I think that the truth is oftentimes kind of in the middle. And it's in finding that truth, or being able to find the best way through a lot of these issues, requires a lot of listening, and it also requires some talking too, right? I think that both of those roles are important for somebody who's seeking to represent people here in the 8th Congressional District. And so when I was in the state legislature, the reason I ran was because there were school cuts in places like Crosby, Ironton, where I was from. And over the course of 10 years, those school cuts pretty radically transformed the set of opportunities that students in Crosby had at the end of that time, as compared to even when I was in school. And the way I think that you work with people is that when I went to the state legislature, I talked about my issue all the time. I brought it up any way I could. I talked about what was going on in our schools. And you know what I found is a lot of the Republicans out there across the state, they had some problems in their schools too, right? They were worried about making sure their kids had opportunity too. And so when we focus our conversations on the issues and not on the personalities, I think it makes it easier to find that common ground. I think it's important that we, you know, share values with one another, to recognize where we're coming from when we come to these arguments or dialogues, and that we work to find common progress. And when I was in the state legislature, I think, and this is a true fact, it was far in excess of 90% of the legislation that was passed with bipartisan support. It was probably, I don't want to say exactly, but it was probably around about 95%.
And what were those years?
I was in the legislature in 2013 and 2014.
Okay.
I was elected in 2012.
Great. So that is not so long ago. Our memories can be short, but they're not that short.
Yeah.
Surely we can return to more bipartisanship. And what I hear you saying is that it's going to take some listening and talking. It seems to me like there needs to be sort of a gut willingness to do that, because everyone always says we need to listen, we need to talk. And then, you know, what's it going to take for it to actually happen? That's, I think, the biggest challenge in front of us. Not that it's not happening. My next question is that we do hear a lot about what's wrong with Congress and our government at every level, I would say. But can you share with us something that you think is going right, or something, you know, a positive sign that you see or you have played?
Well, so one of the things I think that we can be proud of as Americans and proud of as Minnesotans is that over the course of time, we've built a society where there are some bedrock values that I think reflect how we care about one another and how we build a more healthy community. And, you know, there's obviously disagreement about a lot of these policies, but generally speaking, over the course of time, we've recognized that investing in education is important. We've recognized that a social safety net, you know, with Social Security and Medicare is important. We recognize that, you know, trying to find a solution to health care is important. And so I think that, you know, that there are disagreements around these issues, and certainly I have strong positions and strong, you know, I would be eager to draw a strong contrast on these positions between myself and my Republican opponent. But over the course of time, I think that our society has moved forward and recognized the benefit of these programs. And in fact, in Minnesota, you know, one of the things that we were really seeking to protect when I was in the legislature was a thing we called the Minnesota Miracle, which is this basic social agreement that really came about in the 1970s that said, no matter where you're at in the state of Minnesota, no matter what your zip code is, you should have access to a fairly high level of basic services, right? And the way that we paid for those services here in the state of Minnesota is by taking and pooling all of the tax and revenue resources. And a lot of those are generated in the Twin Cities, right? The income tax and the sales tax are largely generated down there. And so we redistributed those across the state to make sure that small towns and rural counties and school districts were all healthy and had enough money. Now, sometimes we take a step back and we need to, you know, make sure that we're protecting those programs. But I think that generally speaking, we've made progress over time.
Yeah, I know one thing that really mattered around here, when local government aid to schools was either dropped or just less, I know it made a huge difference. You may not know this, but we actually have a four-day week here in this district, and a lot of it was due to those budget cuts. And I think that is part of the Minnesota miracle that you're referring to.
Yeah. You know, my stepmom grew up in Two Harbors here. I did not know that they were on a four-day school week. And I think, you know, what's happened to schools in Minnesota over the course of time is that when during the mid-2000s, so like 2002 to 2012, our state faced budget deficit after budget deficit. And instead of asking for a mix of cuts or reforms and revenue increases, especially from those who could most afford it, we just had budget cuts. And what people who are paying attention recognize that just simply not funding something doesn't mean that it doesn't cost more money. The price of gas goes up every year, the price of heating a building, textbooks, all these things, right? They rise in price over time. And so when the state doesn't keep up with their end of the bargain, or when the federal government doesn't keep up their end of the bargain, then it's left on local taxpayers to make up the difference. And that's really what's put a lot of rural school districts in a bind. And schools like Crosby, Arrington, and Two Harbors, I think, are examples of that.
Yeah, well, I know you're speaking to people's hearts here, because the levy, the school levy, is a big, there's no bigger deal when that comes around. All right, so a couple more questions for you. I'm speaking with Joe Radinovich. He is a candidate for political office here in District 8 for U.S. House of Representatives. What distinguishes you as a candidate, Joe? And yeah, I'll just stick with that.
Well, I mean, you know, one of the things I'd point out is you can't tell this maybe by the radio, especially with my gravelly voice today, but
yeah.
I'm a fairly young candidate, right? I'm 32 years old. I was elected to the state legislature when I was 26, and I don't expect to spend a lifetime in government. That's not my aim. But what matters to me is that the decisions that are made in St. Paul and in Washington, D.C. are going to affect me for the duration of my life. They're going to affect my community, my kids, and everything like that. And so, you know, I stood up and took an opportunity to get involved when I had one. And so I'm glad to be out here talking about why these programs are important for the future. And I think that people across generations recognize that we should have some new blood in Washington, D.C., some ideas that represent, I think, you know, the future of this country. One of the other things, though, is that in my short period of time, I've been able to accumulate a fair amount of pretty diverse experiences. So I was a state legislator representing the southwestern portion of this district, which is, you know, Aiken and Crow Wing County, where I've lived my entire life. I was working at the IRRRB for Governor Dayton on the leadership team up there, working on downtown revitalization and rural broadband and an arts and culture initiative that we started up there. I was campaigning across the district for Congressman Nolan and got a real good look at the way the federal government interacts with the people of this district and what his role was. And then actually, I took a little departure too, and I spent a little time down in Minneapolis last year. I was working for my good friend, Mayor Fry. He wasn't the mayor when we started. I ran his campaign. We got him elected, so that worked out pretty well. But that gave me an interesting insight into how Minneapolis works. And this district is so large that it includes communities like Wyoming and North Branch and Cambridge and Isanti.
Right.
And all of those people, or a lot of those people, travel in and out of the metropolitan area on a daily basis. And their livelihoods are really intertwined with that community down there. And it also showed me how cities like Duluth, which is the largest city in the district, of course, might be different than, say, where I grew up in Crosby, Arrington. And you know, so some of those different perspectives I've had along the way, I think, have really well prepared me for this.
Yeah, we have an unbelievably large district and an unbelievably diverse. I mean, I would also say, you know, us North Shoreites, you know, that often bear little relation to what's going on in Pine City, which bears little relation to what's going on in Aiken, which bears little relation to the urban issues of Duluth. So you could not be more right about that. I'm speaking with Joe Radinovich. He is a candidate for political office in District 8. Joe, I can't leave without just asking for a quick, it can't be quick really, but a lot of people around here care about the various mining projects. Do you have anything to say that, I know it would have to be quick. It's hard to be quick.
Well, what I'll say, and trying to be brief about this, is that, you know, I think that this argument is sometimes unnecessarily politicized, right? And I think that there are people on both sides and both administrations who've used this to advance some political points. And I think that in the short term has really made this a very tense argument. But where I see this from a perspective, you know, where I'm at, is that there are two basic sides to this argument. There's one side that says that we need the resources that are necessary to live in the 21st century. And there's another side that says we have to protect the earth. And both of those, of course, are good and correct positions, but the truth is somewhere in the middle. And so I think that the role of the congressperson in this district is not to be a cheerleader for big corporations. I think that that's kind of a troublesome road if we go down it. I also don't think it's to be unilaterally opposed to these projects without seeing the data to back it up. And so what I support is a strong regulatory process. And I think that we can't we cannot allow that process to, you know, be manipulated by politicians in Washington, D.C. and St. Paul. I think that we have to let the process play out. We have to rely on the science, and we have to be able to make decisions that are in accordance with the laws that we have on the books. And we shouldn't have to change them for the benefit of these companies or against them. And if we do that, then we're going to have good information by which to make these decisions as we move forward. And if any project is approved, the most important thing is that we hold those companies accountable to the taxpayer. That means they need to follow our regulations, they need to put up financial assurances, and they need to be bankruptcy proof, because we can't be left holding the bag for these companies.
All right. Thank you, Joe. That was Joe, and we're going to have to sign off now.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in. You're listening to KTWH 995 FM in Two Harbors, Minnesota. It's 8:46, and we're going to have a little more music here before the end of Grounds Control wraps up at 9 o'clock.